Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and hello to our listeners. And Judy, tell us, what is the topic for today?
Today's topic is getting hold of yourself.
Getting hold of yourself, yeah. And just to make sure that perhaps new listeners are oriented to how this whole thing is organized, that is a chapter title from my recently released book, Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Couples Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back, which is available, of course, anywhere books are sold. And what we've been doing in these podcasts is focusing more or less one chapter at a time on the topics that are in that book. And so the book itself is based on a 7-word formula. And Judy, why don't you say what the formula is?
Okay. It is be kind, don't panic, and have faith.
Those are the 7 words. That's, of course, what our podcast is named after. And we're in the don't panic section now. We talked quite a bit about the kindness, the aspect of kindness in our first few podcasts. And last time we talked about trauma. And this time we're talking about the general topic of getting hold of yourself. And what I mean by getting hold of yourself, and I think I comment in the book, I like the metaphor because getting hold of yourself is sort of what a parent does with a child who's really upset. You know, what do you do with a young child who's really upset? To calm them down, you're apt to hold them. You know, mm-hmm. if they're really little, you pick them up and hold them and hug them and just give them a sense that they're okay, even if things aren't going the way they wish they would, which is the way life is fairly often, mm-hmm. that they can still be okay. And that's what you can do for yourself. And it's a really important skill in that general heading of don't panic. And it especially comes up in couple relationships, because if you can't get hold of yourself, it's very difficult then to be kind. If you're freaking out, you know, when your brain has gone into sort of lizard mode, mm-hmm. it's very difficult sure. to actually hear what your partner has to say and be able to respond in a way that's going to be helpful.
That's true. And also, you know, your partner doesn't know how to react to you if you're in that situation. You know, it just spirals more into both of you kind of going off the deep end.
Well, and that's exactly it. You know, when in couples, if you're freaking out each other, then what you have is a pretty nasty cycle. And I talk about that in the book. You know, one of the chiefest skills of in terms of not panicking is the skill, and I do refer to it as a skill, of being out of sync with your partner. What I mean by that is being out of sync with your partner without freaking out. That's really the trick. Because if you're out of sync, you know, partners are very important to each other, or at least that's the kind of partners I'm talking about. And if you're really important to each other and you see that your partner is unhappy with you or even just plain old unhappy with something, then that can raise your own anxiety. And if your anxiety has the effect of raising your partner's anxiety, then you're really in trouble. You're bound to get out of sync occasionally because, you know, partners are two separate people and they're not always going to see things exactly the same way, or they may just have a simple misunderstanding, whatever it might be. And the problem you run into is that if in getting out of sync, that becomes a cause for panic, that can spiral out of control. And so, again, that concept, getting hold of yourself, is really a central concept to being able to be okay in a couple.
You know, one of the things that you talk about in the chapter is the difference between shame and guilt. Why don't you tell us the difference between it and how that impacts somebody getting a hold of themselves?
Yeah, the reason I got into that distinction, shame versus guilt, first of all, I take a position that maybe is slightly different from how many therapists talk these days. First, let me first distinguish between the two. What I mean by shame, and this is a fairly common way of describing the difference. Shame is when you feel you're a terrible person yourself. In other words, shame is when you feel bad about yourself as a person. You're not lovable. You're just generally scum of the earth. That's the feeling of shame. And it relates to that notion of not wanting to show yourself. You know, you want to hide. If you look at the biblical story, that sort of quintessential biblical story in the Garden of Eden, and there were Adam and Eve, and they were ashamed to be seen.
Because they ate from the tree of knowledge.
And specifically knowledge of good and evil.
Right.
Yeah. They ate from that tree. And so they developed this sense of, oh no, I don't want God to see me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the feeling of shame. Guilt is very different. Guilt is a bad feeling, of course, but guilt is a feeling that I've done something wrong. Not that I'm unlovable, but that I've done something wrong. It's about my behavior.
Mm.
And if I feel fundamentally valid about myself as a person, then when I'm feeling guilt, not shame, but guilt, first of all, interesting things can happen with guilt. I could feel guilty even if nobody else knows that I've done something, because guilt is relative to my internal moral compass. So I could feel bad about doing something nobody else ever finds out about. And conversely, I could feel okay about doing something I know to be right, even if many other people disapprove. Because if I'm guided by a moral compass, I might well judge that I'm doing something, you know, I'm going to do the right thing, even though it's not the popular thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is central to being guided by guilt, not by shame. When you're guided by shame, if people find out about it, that's the disaster. So what you find in families, let's say, that are primarily oriented toward shame, the people who are dominant in those families tend to be bullies.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to insist on their way, and if anybody challenges it, they'll never actually listen and admit to possibly doing something wrong. Instead, they'll just assert their authority even more, and often abusively.
Sure.
The chief disaster in a shame-based system is if your reputation is harmed. It makes you seem weak. So in shame-based systems, someone who is dominant tends to be a bully, and someone who is not dominant tends to be bullied in shame-based systems. And in both cases, people who were raised that way are pretty much ruled by the fear of shame.
Mm.
In guilt-based systems, there's this fundamental sense that we are all valid individuals, you know, that I related in the book to that biblical concept of being created B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, that we're all valid people, even when we do wrong, which we, of course, are all apt to do on occasion because we're imperfect. And in a guilt-based system, if you are in a relatively dominant position, there is at least the chance that if someone calls you on it, you'll feel bad about it, and you won't just assert your power, rather you'll actually listen and maybe do something about it. And similarly, if you're in a non-dominant position in a guilt-based system, you will perhaps, I say perhaps, it doesn't always work perfectly, of course, but perhaps you'll feel more entitled to actually speak up if you think something is wrong. And in a well-functioning guilt-based system, the people in power are more apt to listen.
And how does that impact getting hold of yourself?
Well, what happens if you are governed primarily by shame, it is very difficult to get hold of yourself if your partner is upset with you. If your partner is saying, hey, you just did something I wish you hadn't done. If you're governed by shame, all you want to do is stomp that out or get away from it. As opposed to if you're governed by guilt, you know, if you tell me I've done something that has hurt you, if I am confident enough in my own essential validity that I can actually hear you without just going to pieces because of shame, then I actually will look at my behavior and well might say, oh my God, I'm so sorry, and mean it in a way that would be meaningful to you and, of course, possibly effective for me in the simple sense that maybe you'll actually forgive me and we'll both feel better. So, you know, I'm sort of putting in a plug for guilt as opposed to shame. But, you know, I think I mentioned this earlier, or I started to say this earlier anyway, that for a lot of therapists, shame gets a bad rap. It's like for therapists in general, it's like we're all about saying, yeah, guilt is necessary, but shame is terrible because shame just makes you feel like you're not lovable, like you're not a valid human being. I certainly agree with that in general. I mean, the vast majority of the time when I'm working with folks, you know, in my practice, I am trying to help them recover from a lot of shame so that then they can actually feel guilt appropriately, but not excessively.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I often say to people, hey, save guilt for when you've actually done something wrong. You know, people will feel like they're terrible people when they really haven't done anything wrong. They've just done something that someone else didn't like. So indeed, like most other therapists, I'm pretty firmly on the side of helping people recover from shame. But shame has its place. Shame actually is an important function that we've evolved it for important reasons. It can be oppressive, it can be horrible, but shame is also how culture is transmitted. If I didn't feel like, ooh, I don't want people to see me walking down the street naked,
mm-hmm.
that's not about guilt, that's about shame.
Mm-hmm.
that's how our culture has said, no, our cultural norms is that you just don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, there's no really good, solid reason in terms of harming someone else that we shouldn't walk down the street naked, but it wouldn't be our culture if we did that. And there's all sorts of things associated with that. And, you know, I have to put in a shout out here for Jonathan Haidt, who writes about this in his book, The Righteous Mind. The idea that the things that are important to us in developing what our concept of right and wrong is do involve a lot of culturally based ideas, including shame. So, as I say, I don't want to just dismiss shame altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But primarily in terms of getting hold of yourself, it really is about knowing deeply that both parties in a partnership are inherently valid people. And that really means being governed more by guilt than by shame.
One of the other topics that you bring up in the chapter is called getting to the right argument. You want to tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite little phrases. I've been doing this long enough now, I have catchphrases. That somehow seems vaguely pitiful. But anyway, you know, when you're an old guy, that's what happens. What can I tell you?
That you can say it in five words.
That's right.
Getting to the right argument.
Getting to the right argument. So what do I mean by getting to the right argument? The symptom, if I may call it that, often, this is a very common phenomenon. A couple will say, especially early on in our work, we fight about everything. You know, it doesn't even matter what it is.
Right. Fighting about everything and nothing.
Everything right? and nothing. Exactly. That people are saying that, you know, it doesn't take anything to set us off. And that typically means there is something happening there. And the fighting is often a way, not a conscious, intentional way, but the fighting is often a way to avoid the really scary possibility, which is what I call the right argument. Now, of course, it depends on the couple, what the right argument might be. When you get hold of yourself enough to not freak out about scary possibilities, and, you know, one of the scariest possibilities for a lot of couples is they might have to look at the possibility of splitting up. They mm-hmm. might say, oh, my God, sure. We are two good people and we're just not right for each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our values don't coincide, or, you know, there's other reasons why we just can't seem to be okay with each other. That's a very scary possibility, especially for a couple that is very invested in each other, that loves each other and has been together. And
might have children.
Exactly. All of those are really scary possibilities. So that's sometimes what it is. Sometimes it isn't even that. Sometimes it's just this sort of unspoken sense that, oh, you know, you just don't love me and I love you and I can't stand the thought that you don't love me, but I can't bring myself to really ask you or even think that out loud. So it's just scary. And so, you know, if I'm freaking out at that thought, pretty much anything that you would do that would suggest that possibility to me might get me all upset, as opposed to saying, wow, I'm worried about some of the ways you've been behaving and I'm not sure how you feel about me. So that concept of getting to the right argument, it's not like people can write on a bumper sticker exactly what the right argument is. I gave an example in the book of a fairly simple situation where a couple, what turned out to be their right argument, they'd been living together for quite a while, but they kept fighting about everything and nothing and realized they had very different views of where they were going. And they hadn't really enunciated that. They'd mm-hmm. been avoiding it because it seemed too scary to the relationship. He did not want to get married. He did not want to merge their finances. He didn't want to move closer to the grandkids. You know, it was a very different kind of situation. And she did, and was thinking he did too. And it came out in all sorts of ways, except actually being honest with themselves about it. And when they were, and this is a general phenomenon, when you get to the right argument, you know, how do you know when you get to the right argument? It stops being squabbling. It stops being nasty. It doesn't stop being scary. In fact, it is often scarier. It's like, oh boy.
Yeah, because then you have to confront what the actual problem is.
Exactly. And there's, of course, look, the vast majority of people I work with are not crazy. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You're avoiding the problem for good reason.
Sure.
And so they're avoiding it because it's scary. It's a normal phenomenon. So when they get to the right argument, what happens is they stop squabbling about everything and nothing. And it's interesting. And they'll often come back after a session where we've talked about this and say that it's like, well, we're not fighting anymore. But it doesn't mean that they're all happy.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, occasionally it does mean that. Occasionally it's like, you know, we realize we actually aren't disagreeing as much as we feared. You know, once you get down to it, maybe I suddenly start thinking, I'm fine doing it your way. I don't know what I was worried about, but when I really, you know, stop panicking about it, it's like, I like doing it your way. I'd rather put a smile on your face right now, and that would be a win for me. You know, it's not like a win-lose.
Yeah.
So that's a delightful possibility. But the other possibility is, wow, we don't know how to solve this, and we're going to have to either sit with it for a while and just experience the anxiety with respect, knowing, wow, I see why you feel the way you feel, and I see why I feel the way I feel, and this is not comfortable, but we haven't figured this out yet. Or sometimes, sadly, people say, wow, this is not going to work, and they move on, mm-hmm. you know, again, with
and
compassion.
They need to break up.
Yeah, they need to break up. Yeah. So it does happen.
Well, we have come to the portion of our program where we take our listener questions. So today's question, Melanie writes, Dear Dr. Chalmer, Larry and I have been together for 6 years. We're both in our 30s. About 2 years ago, Larry cheated on me. I found out, and after a lot of drama, we decided to stay together. He was very contrite and swears it won't happen again. Dr. Chalmer, I do believe his cheating happened because we were going through a rough patch. He's not a habitual cheater, and I really don't think he'll cheat again. But now every time he gets a text or a phone call late at night, I can't help but be suspicious. If I say something, he gets angry and says, Do you want to see my phone? Or tells me to stop it because I'm going to drive him away. I'm afraid that's what I'm doing, but I can't help it. How do I stop? I want to trust him, and he hasn't done anything since that time to make me mistrust him. But I come from a family where my dad cheated on my mom, and after Larry cheated once, what's to stop him from doing it again? I really love him, but I don't know how to stop suspecting him. What can I do? What can we do?
Yeah, well, and you know, maybe for our listeners, you can see why we picked out this particular question for this particular topic. You know, what she's saying, in, you know, not in so many words, but what she's saying is, how can I get hold of myself?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that doesn't answer her last question. What can I do? What can we do?
Right.
But what she's recognizing, and I think this is such a great example of it, what she's recognizing is precisely that she has to start by getting hold of herself. And she's realizing that her freaking out every time he gets a text or you know, a late night phone call or something is not helping.
Yeah. But how do you do that?
But how do you do that? Exactly. Yeah. So this is another reason this is a particularly nice example is that it's not impossible that he's cheating again. You know, no amount of checking. And it's so interesting to me when I work with couples where there's been infidelity, which is very, very common in my practice. I mm-hmm. mean, I once just took a rough guess as to what proportion of the couples I work with, there's been some infidelity. And, you know, kind of a rough guess is around 30 or 40%, I think. I think I said something like that. It's not at all uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly possible that he could be cheating again, though she's pretty sure he isn't. But her being suspicious of it is a normal human phenomenon. Once you've been hurt by something, what are you supposed to do? Turn off your evolutionary system that says you should be anxious if you encounter something that reminds you of a past danger? You're not going to turn that off.
Mm-hmm.
So she's going to have that issue. And I would say, if I may be a little bit, you know, positively judgmental, I'd say, well, good for her for recognizing that this is hers to deal with. It's not only hers to deal with. Larry has his role in this, of course, obviously. But it is really for her to get hold of herself and recognize she can't 100% trust the world that it will never hurt her.
Mm-hmm.
Melanie can never trust that Larry will never, ever cheat on her any more than Larry could trust that Melanie would never cheat on him. What they can trust is that somehow they'll figure it out. They'll get through it. Not necessarily together, by the way, but that life is still livable.
Yeah, but I'm not hearing any indication from her that he's doing anything to reassure her. Other than the fact that he was contrite. But what is he doing now? I mean, I know it's a letter, so she just, you know, not telling you the whole story. But mm-hmm. I guess when couples come to see you with that, you know, I'd want to know, what is he doing that is assuaging her fears?
Yeah.
You know?
And the main thing he needs to do, and I want to put in parenthetically here, we're going to have a chapter later on about infidelity, and mm-hmm. we'll be talking about a lot of that. The main thing he needs to do is to be clear with himself and this may sound paradoxical, but he needs to be clear with himself that his cheating wasn't crazy. It was meaningful. It was wrong. Don't get me wrong. It was wrong. It was morally wrong by most people's morality, certainly by mine, and from the sound of it, by Larry's and Melanie's as well. So it's not like it was that makes it okay. But if he just says it was a moment of craziness, I'll never do it again, there is no guarantee whatever that he wouldn't do it again, because he's refusing to face his own choices.
Mm-hmm.
So what he can do that would make his being sorry about it credible for Melanie is actually fearlessly, as much as possible, examine what was happening for him. Mm-hmm. And there is a hint in this letter that Melanie sort of understands that. It's when she said, you know, I believe his cheating happened because we were going through a rough patch. Again, she wasn't saying that made it okay. I don't know Larry, but I'm guessing he probably isn't saying that either. But it is a context for it that she could understand. You know, that's she sort of implies that in the letter. So she sort of understands how it could happen. So she's not saying this is all on him to reassure me constantly. You know, the tendency that couples have early on when infidelity is discovered is for the person who was cheated on to turn into the other person's probation officer. And it doesn't work. It's, it's not the kind of relationship they want to have. If the relationship is going to heal, rarely would a couple want to be in a relationship where it's based on the fact that one of them is a terrible person and the other one is tolerating them. Do you know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah.
It's going to have to be that both Larry and Melanie can see themselves as valid people worthy of forgiveness and worthy of love. And so that early phase where she feels, you know, understandably, she feels like, hey, you owe me, fella. If I'm asking you something, you better answer it, and you better answer it willingly, and you better not be mad about my saying it, you know? There is a phase of that. But you reach a certain point where, you know, when she's quoting him as, well, I'm looking at the letter here, you know, if I say something, he gets angry and says, do you want to see my phone? Or tells me to stop because I'm going to drive him away. My sense of her letter is she realizes, well, she says that. I'm afraid that's what I'm doing. She realizes, yeah, even though, yes, he did a terrible thing, he's right about that. She doesn't want to poison the relationship any more than he did by cheating. She doesn't want to poison it by being constantly suspicious. So the tricky thing for the person in the position she's in, the one who was cheated on, is to recognize, first of all, she needs to get hold of herself. And from the letter, she's already gone there. You know what I mean? She already sees that. So that's a good start.
Well, she just wants to find out what they can do and what she can do to get hold of herself, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Clearly, it is very much, you know, whether or not this relationship is going to be okay.
I think they need to come see you.
Well, thank you for the referral. You can give her my card. Yes,
or a couples therapist,
or a couples therapist. Yeah, and of course,
because it's hard to build up those trust once you've broken it.
Yes,
I think they really need to work on building up their trust issues.
Absolutely, and look, there are plenty of people who can reach the point of forgiveness even, and nevertheless say, "Well, I forgive you. I can even understand why you did it." But I simply can't be married to someone who had done that to me.
Mm.
Even though I think you're a valid person and I think you'll make a great partner for someone else, but I can't possibly be married to someone who did that.
Yeah.
I've heard people say that and I respect that. And it's certainly possible.
Yeah, but if they do want to stay together, and it seems like she does, then I think they really need to work on those trust issues.
Yeah. And, just to kind of wrap this up again in terms of our topic, a sort of prerequisite for working on those trust issues is, in fact, getting hold of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't solve the problem. It's like the same thing I said about getting to the right argument. Getting to the right argument doesn't solve the problem, mm-hmm. but it makes it at least possible to
work on.
Right,
it brings clarity.
Exactly.
Right. Well, if you have questions that you would like to send to us, you can email bruce@brucechalmer.com or visit brucechalmer.com, and maybe we will put your question on the air.
And when you visit brucechalmer.com, go to the podcast tab. That's one way of, one way of hearing these podcasts. And you will note that we are also asking for people who would like to be interviewed on the program. We've already done a couple of them. They've turned out to be really popular, and we had a lot of fun doing them as well. And if you think you might be a good fit for our program, and to be a good fit for our program, we have a pretty wide net, so to speak. We're willing to talk about anything that might even remotely relate to couples, just interesting folks who have interesting things to say about it. So if you're interested in that, please go to brucechalmer.com and go to the podcast tab, and you can actually sign up for a time slot. And when you do that, we'll be asking you, gee, what would you like us to ask you about? And that's how we'll get a sense of whether we think you'll be a good fit for the program. So, Judy, tell us about what is our next topic for our next episode.
Okay, it is called, What is Faith?
Indeed, and you know the seven-word formula that you told us about earlier, be kind, don't panic, and have faith. We're now getting into the third section of that. And we'll talk about what I mean by faith. And I have to say, in terms of the book, this is kind of the big differentiator for this book. I've pointed out in some of the posts I've done about the book, there's lots of good books about relationships out there. I've certainly learned a lot from them, and I'll bet a lot of you have as well. My particular spin, the thing that I think differentiates this book more than anything else about the book, is my a view of the role of faith in relationships. And it isn't necessarily religious faith, though it can be quite consistent with religious faith. So I invite you to come back and check us out at that point. The book that I keep referring to is called Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Couples Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. It is available wherever books are sold. You can also find a direct link to a place to order it from my website, brucechalmer.com.
Thank you for listening, and remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.